Chapter 4. The President Throws in the Towel. When someone puts an end to something, it doesn't mean that he gave up. It means that thing is not taking him anywhere. So said Michael Bassey Johnson. The Constitutional Court is a creation of the post-liberation Constitution. In the old South Africa, it did not exist. In those years, South Africa had a sovereign parliament, which put white and mainly male parliamentarians at the apex of power. Now, in our constitutional democracy, this place has been taken by the Constitution, which is supreme. No other law or government action can supersede the provisions of the Constitution. Among other things, this means politicians can't do what they like, and the laws they pass have to comply with the Constitution. No such constraints applied in the old system. This change is one of the major differences between the old and the new South Africa. In the latter, any law or conduct that is inconsistent with the Constitution and the rule of law, which also has supreme status, is invalid and liable to be struck down or corrected by the courts. The Constitutional Court has the final say about whether contested laws or actions comply with the Constitution. This is very different from the far weaker role played by courts in the apartheid era and in preceding dispensations since Union in 1910. The Constitutional Court also differs from the Supreme Court of Appeal in that it has more than appellate jurisdiction. As noted briefly in the previous chapter, it is possible, in certain circumstances, to approach the court directly as a court of first instance. It prefers to sit as an appellate tribunal that has the benefit of the analysis of the lower courts, but does not shirk from exercising original jurisdiction when the occasion demands this and when it is in the interest of justice to do so. The matter between Terry Crawford Brown and the President was such an instance. The President's conduct in refusing to appoint a commission of inquiry into possible malfeasance or misfeasance in the arms procurement processes was under scrutiny for its compliance with the Constitution and its consistency with the rule of law. A constitutional court hearing was not Terry's first choice. A completed trial in the Western Cape High Court would have better suited his strategy, as it would have enabled him to subpoena the financial records of the ANC in order to establish the link between bribes paid and political party funding before the trial. This outcome did not materialize. The President's legal team prevented Terry from proceeding in the High Court by taking an exception which seemed highly arguable and would have delayed the matter for years if litigated through the High Court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, and finally the Constitutional Court. Following the Fred Daniel case, we now know that the Constitutional Court does not regard a disputed request for a commission of inquiry as something that falls within its exclusive jurisdiction. In the bigger scheme of things, Terry secured a hearing without the delays and expenses involved in the usual route via the High Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal due to the tactics adopted against him. However, as the Constitutional Court does not hear trials, it was not possible to subpoena documents to show the existence of bribes for the benefit of the ANC. To that extent, the President's tactics worked to the benefit of him and his political party. The Constitutional Court is housed in a beautiful new building on Constitutional Hill in Brompton, Johannesburg, the site of a fort which became a notorious prison built by Paul Kruger's government in the old Boer Republic. The entire precinct has been restored and remodeled, and the old fort prison is now a museum and exhibition centre. The awaiting trial wing was demolished, and the bricks were used to help build the court building. The court building has large street-level windows meant to symbolise the transparent administration of justice. In practice, it means that court sessions are visible to pedestrians outside the building, and those in the courtroom can see the feet of pedestrians on the pavement outside. The court houses an impressive art collection, and its interior is tastefully decorated. In a bow to tradition, the long curved bench where the judges sit during court sessions is covered with the hides of indigenous Nguni cattle. There is ample provision for members of the public, and the court is always as neat as a pin, with polished floors and polite staff. It has become a tourist attraction, deservedly so, and retired justices are wont to offer tours laced with anecdotes to those who visit it. Thoughts of tours and anecdotes could not have been further from our minds as we prepared argument for the hearing set down for the 5th of May 2011. Terry flew up on the morning of the hearing to spare himself the cost of accommodation. Peter Hazel and I were given a free room each in the rectory of St. Mary's Anglican Church in Zettenville, courtesy of my sister and brother-in-law, Peter and Rod Greville. He was the priest in charge. We did not dare rely on any airlines to get us to court in time by flying on the day. Charles Abrams, our intrepid instructing attorney, and Terry's long-standing advisor, had other business in Johannesburg and spent the night before the hearing in a hotel in Braamfontein near the court. We met him in good time on the morning of the hearing and made our way to the court in a state of nervous anticipation. The Constitutional Court always sits en banc. While 8 justices form a quorum, all 11 often take their places on the bench. Facing this array of judicial talent is a daunting experience, even for the most experienced counsel. 11 highly intelligent people picking your arguments to pieces is frightening enough. When this happens in public in the full glare of the media, it is terrifying. When those 11 people are the cream of the country's judges, one can only cope by going into adrenaline overdrive. The judges are seldom hostile and never rude. Their questions are aimed at testing the arguments put forward by the various parties. Sometimes, though, it seems as if all of them want their questions answered at the same time. Counsel in a given matter are normally greeted by the presiding judge, usually the Chief Justice or the Deputy Chief Justice, in a lounge elsewhere in the building. Pleasantries are exchanged. Each advocate is given a certain amount of time for his or her presentation, a measure aimed at hearing matters efficiently and economically. This court is not a place for waffling. Cases are largely won and lost on the heads of argument filed, and oral arguments rarely play a decisive role. This procedure was not observed on the 5th of May 2011, when counsel for the President and the amicus curiae joined us at the court, robed and ready for action. Instead, counsel were called into the justice's boardroom, where the Chief Justice awaited us. These sorts of meetings are confidential, so I can't report on what happened. The meeting did not take long, and we all trooped back to court with a better understanding of how the matter would be heard. After the matter had been formally called in open court, and counsel, Maruma Marani, for the government, Max du Plessis for the amicus, and I introduced our teams, I was asked to start argument. Very soon, though, Chief Justice Sandile Ntlobo presented us with a stark choice. We could either proceed with the application asking the court to compel the President to deal with the merits of Terry's case, or we could press on without the benefit of the President's version of events. Morani was given a similar choice. Was he prepared to rely solely on technical defences or respond to Terry's allegations? We took instructions and consulted with the team representing the Institute for Race Relations. The court's willingness to press on without a response from the respondents heartened us all, as the merits would have to be regarded as undisputed. We decided to abandon the application to compel the filing of affidavits on the merits and get on with our case. Morani wanted the hearing to be confined to technical points and to be given an opportunity to submit an affidavit concerning the merits at a later stage, should the need arise. The judges, would have none of this. Morani was in a corner, and quite rightly, did not have much confidence in his technical arguments. We were in the Constitutional Court because of the exception he had taken to a High Court hearing, and the mood of the judges seemed to indicate that they were prepared to entertain the matter in its entirety. So the President then asked for time to file affidavits dealing with the merits, something he clearly tried to avoid up until then. The judges were prepared to grant us a short period in which to get the papers into the order they wanted. This would involve amplifying our lean and mean submissions, to which the President's team would need to respond. It was clear that the judges wanted to get to grips with the merits and did not want to hear technical arguments first and arguments on the merits later. Morani was driven to ask for a postponement to prepare his amplified affidavits. The judges provided the parties with a new timetable, culminating in a hearing on the 20th of September 2011, a mere 4 months later. Terry was understandably disappointed that the case had not been finalized. Our decision to abandon the application, aimed at compelling the President to deal with the merits, had been a gamble, aimed at getting the matter heard on the papers as they stood. This carried the risk that our lean and mean papers would not contain enough to justify a conclusion that the President's refusal to appoint a commission of inquiry was irrational or unreasonable. Issues surrounding hearsay evidence and rumours of impropriety could be addressed by obtaining further affidavits and shoring up Terry's case in this way. We were out of the court building before our cars had time to heat up in the autumn sun. However, this damp squib was not our first surprise. A few days later, the Chief Justice issued directions designed to put an end to requests for further delays. In essence, he instructed the parties to supplement their papers by setting out the evidence relevant to the case by way of affidavits, including affidavits from witnesses able to confirm the allegations made. We had to lodge our supplementary papers by the 15th of June, and the respondents had to lodge their response by the 1st of August. Following this, we had to lodge supplementary written arguments by the 15th of August, the amicus curiae by the 15th of August, and the first respondent, the President, by 29th August. We set to work immediately to beef up the bare-bones case we had presented. This involved assembling many documents and taking affidavits from witnesses ranging from Andrew Feinstein, the former ANC Member of Parliament and SCOPA member, to Jonathan Shapiro, the cartoonist better known as Shapiro. His cartoons on the arms deals were critical of the government and Presidents Mbeki and Zuma in ways that could have but did not provoke defamation claims. Given the weight and scope of evidence, the President asked for more time to deal with the allegations. Accordingly, on the 15th of August, the court issued new directions to the effect that the hearing had been moved from the 20th of September to the 17th of November. Now, our supplementary papers had to be lodged by the 15th of June and the respondent's response by the 15th of September 2011. We had to lodge our supplementary written argument by 29th September, the amicus curiae by 29th September, and the first respondent by 13th October. My heart sank as I read these dates. It meant I would receive a huge pile of paper on the 15th of September, the date of my wedding anniversary, and the President's supplementary argument on my birthday. I hoped the response to the supplemented founding papers would arrive late on the 15th of September so that I could still enjoy the anniversary. We duly submitted our supplementary papers. It was clear that a gargantuan task awaited anyone wishing to dispute Terry's allegations. The big day, 15th September, dawned bright and clear. My wife Elise and I decided to celebrate early, in the certain knowledge that a lot of work would start later. I switched off my phone and we lunched at a posh hotel with a good view of the sea. Imagine my surprise when I turned on the phone an hour or so later and found 44 new messages. While we were lunching, the president had thrown in the towel. He'd announced a decision to appoint a commission of inquiry and would file no opposing papers beyond a short affidavit. In essence, it said he did not concede that declining to appoint a commission of inquiry into the arms deal was unconstitutional. However, because the litigation had started so long ago, and there were several developments since then, with a bearing on his decision, he had decided to appoint a commission. Its terms of reference, composition, and time frame would be announced later. Given this, there was no longer any dispute between the applicant and the respondents that required the determination of the Constitutional Court. In order to finalise the matter, the respondents would carry the costs of the application thus far. The rest of the wedding anniversary celebrations were far more exuberant. The first journalist to get hold of me was Paul Kirk, then working for The Citizen in KwaZulu-Natal. His call came through as I was trawling through the 44 messages, most of them from other reporters. When he told me about the announcement, I asked him not to crack jokes about such a serious matter, but he insisted that the announcement appeared to be genuine. It began to dawn on me why there were so many messages on my phone. The impossible had happened. Terry would get the inquiry, and we had done it without proving irrationality in court. The president had new advisers in the matter led by Nazir Kasim, SC of the Johannesburg Bar. Kasim phoned me and we tidied up loose ends about costs. In the light of the president's vault farce, they even agreed to pay the costs of the amicus curiae. Not entirely clear why they changed their minds. Perhaps the president wanted to retain control of the situation and feared that the court might impose onerous conditions on him. Perhaps he had accepted advice that his prospects of success were not good. We will never know, and don't really need to know. He had thrown in the towel, and that was all that mattered for the moment. In a final effort, Terry asked the court to rule that retired rather than sitting judges should be appointed to the commission on the grounds that it would be easier to compromise sitting judges who were eager for promotion by the executive branch of government, or to create the impression that they'd been compromised. The same suspicion of bias is less likely to arise in the case of a retired judge who would no longer harbour such ambitions. While this made eminent sense in practical terms, it was a bit of a stretch in legal terms, and the president's attorney objected in an affidavit that accurately set out the relevant points of law. It was our turn to throw in the towel. We did not press the point, and the matter was dealt with by consent when it was called in open court on the 17th of November, just over a year after our first approach to the Constitutional Court. Only one advocate representing the President appeared in court to note the withdrawal of the application and the agreement in respect of costs. In this way, the long-awaited Seriti Commission, or Arms Procurement Commission of Inquiry, came into being, exactly 3 years after the Social Justice Coalition had begun its campaign.